has been in our movement since 1934. He said, just in passing, that he joined the YPSL in 1916, but he never told me what he did between 1916 and 1934. I don't know. In 1936, he was vice president of the Workers' Alliance, which was an unemployed workers' group. In 1936 also, he helped with an organizing campaign, the Agricultural Workers Union in California. In 1937, he was editor of the West Coast Fireman. 1938, he was editor of the West Coast Sailor. In 1938 and 39, he was organizer and international representative of the Seafarers International Union. Here he was working, organizing fish cannery workers. 1940 and 41, he was editor of the Seafarer's Log. Then in 1944, he was staff editor for the Militant when the leadership of the SWP went to jail. 1945, he was organizer of the New York Local, and incidentally, all along here, he was organizer of many different party locals. 1948, he became editor of the Militant. And recently, he's been national organizational secretary of the Socialist Workers' Party, and now he's editor of the ISR. Now, I'm sure he's done a lot else, but that's all I could get out of him on the way to the car, especially between 1916 and 1934. If you all notice that Tom seems a little bit sad when he's up here talking, it's probably because one of his very fondest animals, his little snail, well, actually it was a very large snail, named Felix, died very suddenly while he was off on vacation. And for anybody who knew Felix, you can understand why he would be so unhappy. I think we should all go out of our way to extend a special welcome to him because of it.
Chairman, comrades, from 1916 to 19, what was it? Well, I was thinking. Now, I'm going to schedule for four lectures. Two on the development of the labor movement from the period following the First World War to date. As one, rather. And two, the development of the Socialist Workers' Party from its origin in 1928 to date. So you see, I'm going to try and take in quite a bit of territory. I can only give the history of these two correlative developments very sketchily and shall depend a great deal on your questions to fill in the many gaps that I will have to leave in the presentation. Now, I've put on the board here some of the main turning points in the history of the labor movement following the First World War. The lecture on the labor movement will be in two parts, from the First World War to the Second World War, and from the post-war period to the present day. The history of the party will follow more or less in the same framework. In the recent period, especially since 1958, there have been a number of learned contributions made on the status and the perspective of the American labor movement. Most have been very pessimistic. The general consensus is that the labor movement has, in the words of one of our more erudite bourgeois commentators, the labor movement has reached a plateau. plateau both of membership and of ideology, and that it is in a state of real crisis, lacking leadership that has any genuine perspective, and with an objective development that apparently seems to doom the labor movement to gradual attrition. And most predict death unless there's a complete change both in the ideology, the leadership, the program, and the policy of the American labor movement. Now, there's a great deal of truth in the critique that is presented of the present labor movement, that is, its present leadership, and its lack of both program, policy, and perspective. The question for us is and always has been, what will be the dominant force or factor in the coming American Revolution? And we've always answered that the American working class must play a dominant and decisive role because of its strategic position that it occupies in the American economy. Two, what will be the form of the coming radicalization of the American working class? And it is in answering these two questions that we will give the framework of the question. Now, maybe I ought to, tonight, put on the other side of this blackboard the major turning points in party history. 1920 or 21, the government union busting campaign was accompanied by the witch hunts against the radicals. Palmer Red Rays, District United States Attorney General Palmer, at that time, who initiated the tremendous persecution of radicals, especially of alien radicals, and their deportation in the thousands without going through the formality of even a hearing or a trial. 1921 or 29, though comrades who read Comrade Cannon's book on the 10 years of the American Communist Movement will remember were the dog days of the Communist Party. The Communist Party degenerated and became conservatized and bureaucratized. 1928, 29, Sixth World Congress. Sixth World Congress of the Communist International, in which the Stalin turn executed its left turn. You'll see later what effect it had upon this development on this side of the chart. Election of Roosevelt in 1932, 1933. Hitler victory in Germany. Sixth World Congress, which was the ultra-left turn, to the ultra-right turn of the People's Front, 1935, the Seventh World Congress. 1936, Spanish Civil War. Socialist Workers' Party. Now, in World War I, which broke out in 1914, which was proclaimed as the war to end all wars and the war for democracy, the union bureaucracy entered into very close collaboration with the government and subordinated the union movement to the carrying on of the war, to the winning of the war. And in doing so, they entered into the traditional form of class collaboration, the tripartite board, in which representatives of the union, the employers, and the government decided all questions involving controversy between the workers and the employers in the country, and resolved them on the basis of compulsory arbitration, compulsory in quotes. The union movement grew considerably during the period of the war. And with the end of the war in 1918, there developed the recession, the depression rather, of 1921. In the 1921 depression, and even prior to it in 1920, the government emerged as the spearhead of an anti-union drive, where the government itself took the initiative in smashing the unions. Or though many of those unions which had succeeded in organizing a section of the workers in the mass industries, in the maritime industry, for example, even against the opposition of some employers, reduced the union movement to a mere shell of what it had been during the wartime period. The government emerged as a strike breaker in the period of 1920-21. And let's say the same period, the Attorney General Palmer launched his attack upon all the radicals in the Palmer Red Raids. From 1921 to 1929, the country experienced a period of economic recovery and boom. It was one of the longest and most sustained booms for a considerable period of time. I have it marked, the American plan was during this period that there came into being the formations known as company unions, or employee representation plans, in which the company would collaborate with representatives of their own employees in the formation of what they called independent unions, representing the employees, but completely dependent upon the company, and no independent power or authority. It was many of these unions which later provided the basis for the formation of these CIO unions in a later period. It played a very important role in that respect. A large part of the CIO arose out of the company unions that were organized during the American Plan period. The American Plan was supposed to be based upon the concept that the class struggle was outdated for America, that it may have been valid for Europe. But in the United States, the entrepreneur, such as Henry Ford, for example, who had established the $5 day and the mass production process, had outdated Karl Marx and rendered Marx obsolete. And that in this country, the economy and the welfare of the people would continue on an ever-rising scale due to American ingenuity and enterprise and exceptionalism. American exceptionalism, which precluded for this country the experience that the European working class and capitalist class had gone through for many, many years. That dream came to a sudden end in the stock market crash of October 1929. Now, the stock market crash of 1929 heralded the advent of the deepest economic depression that the world had seen up to that time. It was a worldwide depression sparked by the collapse of the American economy. The United States emerged out of World War I, had gone into World War I as a debtor nation, emerged out of World War I as a creditor nation. Similar to the experience following World War II, it had a virtual monopoly of the world market after World War I because it wasn't directly involved in the war. That is, there was none of the war damage done to the United States that there was to the European industrial economy, and was in a favored position. And the reliance upon the entire capitalist world market on American industry and the American economy was so close and so dependent that the crash in 1929 quickly spread throughout the entire world and created a worldwide crisis. The worldwide crisis of 1929 resulted in the New Deal in this country of 1933 and in fascism in 1933 in Germany. The United States was fat enough and rich enough to be able to grant concessions to the working class of this country, which the German capitalist class was unable to do, and which it had to resort to outright repression and force, as Italy did in 1921 with the advent of Mussolini, the beginning of the fascist movement on the American continent. Now, the stock market crash came as a tremendous shock to the entire American people. That is, not only the capitalists, but to the workers, who had been fed upon this illusion that American prosperity was a permanent, fixed, and inevitable outcome of the American dream. Every man could become a capitalist. No class division, no class society, no class struggle in this country. And for a number of years, the shock of the 29 crash, which resulted in the depression, completely prostrated the American working class. There was no such thing as unemployment compensation, pensions, security, all of these things came later as part of the New Deal. The theory of the government was that the government was not responsible for what happened to the individual in society, that the humanitarian instincts of the American people itself were sufficient, or should be sufficient, to take care of their more unfortunate brethren who, for one reason or another, are unable to take care of themselves. And so the unemployed at that period, the problem of the unemployed was shifted to private charity, to the local communities, and to the various states. And it took the form originally more or less of home relief. From the period 1929 to 1932, when Roosevelt was elected as president, Hoover, who was then president, followed consistently this philosophy that the federal government had no responsibility for the welfare of its individual citizens, that this was a matter for the communities and the states. Even he, though, was compelled. Week passed into month, and month passed into year, and there was no relief, there was no upturn, the economy continued to slide downward, to initiate certain supporting measures by the federal government in the form of loans to the states, grants to the states, in order for them to take care of the mounting number of unemployed. Now, there was no real difference between Roosevelt and Hoover in 1932. 1932, Roosevelt was governor of the state of New York. His philosophy was no different than that of Hoover or of any other representative of the American capitalist class. As the governor of New York, he followed the same philosophy on a state scale that Hoover followed on a national scale, granting support to the various localities of the state in the form of loans and grants by the state of New York to the various community. At that time, when the president was elected in November, he did not take office until March. They've subsequently changed that. Now the president takes office in January, isn't it? January 1st, 1933. It used to be there was a certain hiatus where the lame duck administration would continue in office from November until the following March. When Roosevelt took office in March 1933, the Depression had reached about its lowest point. You had the national bank holiday. Banks were failing on a national scale, some of the biggest banks in the country. The entire monetary system was being undermined. The unemployed had amounted to something like 15 or 18 million out of a much lower population than was today, and there began what has gone down in history of the first 100 days of the New Deal. You remember, I think, when Kennedy was running for office in 1960, he projected also the promise that that there would be a repetition of Kennedy's first 100 days in Congress of the first 100 days of Roosevelt's New Deal. Well, in the first 100 days of Roosevelt's New Deal, there were initiated most of the social legislation that exists on the books today. PWA, WPA, the CWA, all of those works projects initiated by the governor, which the federal government took direct responsibility for providing make work for the unemployed. Not all of them, but for a large part of the unemployed throughout the country. It had been demonstrated that by that time that neither the communities nor the states were able by their own resources to cope with this tremendous mounting problem of unemployment, which spread on an ever-increasing scale throughout the years from 1929 to 1933, when Roosevelt declared the bank holiday. Then subsequently, if you remember, all the bank deposits were guaranteed by the federal government, a measure which still exists to the present day, up to $10,000, in order to restore confidence in the banking system. But also as part of his 100-day social reform, Roosevelt introduced the National Recovery Act. Part of the National Recovery Act was the National Labor Relations Board set up with Section 7A. Section 7A granted the workers the right to organize in unions of their own choosing and to bargain collectively with the employers. Now, that did not mean, as the workers soon found out, that this right that was granted them meant automatically that the employers were compelled to recognize this right. On the contrary, they discovered that in order to win the right, they had to go out on strike in some of the most dynamic and militant struggles in the whole history of the American labor movement, struggles that preceded the rise of the CIO a few years later. Now, what was the character of the trade union movement in this period? Following the 1921 union-busting campaign by the government, the trade union movement was reduced to a very thin strata, comprising essentially the labor aristocracy, that is, the workers in the AFL building trades and metal trades unions. Carpenters, bricklayers, teamsters, so forth and so on. A very thin strata, numbering some 2 million out of the entire workforce. That was the residue of the union movement after the 2021 depression. Now, the AFL, the philosophy of the AFL labor leadership at that time, was that of the job trust. That is, they were concerned solely with winning concessions for this very thin layer of workers organized in the American Federation of Labor. Or as Gompers summed up his philosophy, he says his philosophy is more. In one word, more. That is, he wanted more of the division of the pie for those workers represented by the AFL, not the majority of the workers, understand. Just those workers organized in the American Federation of Labor. The aristocracy of labor or the job trust, and at the expense of the overwhelming majority. With the end of the war, there was a tremendous boom in the industry from the period 1921 to 1921. Industry expanded on a tremendous scale. And there were the huge concentrations in the industrial cities, auto, rubber, steel, electricity, and so forth and so on, all of which workers remained outside of the American Federation of Labor. And there was no attempt to organize them. At that time, the industrial workers of the world was prominent. The radicals all advocated the industrial form of organization. They said that was the only form of organization that would conform with the objective development of industry on a mass scale. That you could not divide the workers in the mass production plants into their various craft categories. Or if you tried, you would find that there would be so many, and there would be so many overlapping jurisdictions and so much jurisdictional dispute that it would be a very ineffective and impossible form of organization. The resistance of the employers to organization of the mass production workers, the workers in the mass production industry, at that time even exceeded in its ferocity, in its savageness, the repression against the radicals. In fact, in many industrial towns, in many company union towns, socialists were tolerated without even persecution on the part of the real power in those communities, which were the industrialists, whether they be steel, auto, rubber, or whatever, what have you. But union organizers were treated very summarily and ridden out of town the first moment they showed their head. That is, the organization of the unions was considered by the employers as the deadliest threat to the hegemony over their industrial empires. It wasn't the politician, it wasn't the working class politician who were considered much of a threat, but the unions and the union organizations. So much so that there was a general feeling in the radical movement that it would be much easier to organize the socialist revolution and the overturn of capitalism in this country than to organize the industrial workers in these plants. It was generally acceded by many outstanding radicals and Marxists and syndicalists that it would be easier to organize a social revolution than to organize the workers in these industrial plants. And they had very good reason for believing that. Ford, if you remember, had his security force, a force which not only operated on the job, but actually spied upon the individual workers and subjected them to summary treatment if they were found even talking to a union man, let alone signing a union card. There was no such thing as signing a union card in those days anyway. The National Labor Relations Board wasn't even existing. In March, that is in the first 100 days of the New Deal, Roosevelt and the New Dealers saw that in order to resuscitate American capitalism, which was in a period of mortal crisis, they would have to make some concessions to the American working class. They made considerable concessions to the industrialists, to the financiers, to the bankers, to the employers. But to offset that, they felt compelled to make certain concessions to the workers, and they did this in the form of Section 7A of the National Labor Relations Act, granting the workers the right to organize in unions of their own choosing. For this whole period, there was an acute agricultural crisis, long before the crisis of 1929, the industrial, economic, financial crisis of 1929. There had been an agricultural crisis for the whole period following World War I. This erupted, especially after 1929, in farmers' holidays, farmers' strikes, and a very radicalized movement among the farmers, part of Roosevelt's social reform legislation met in subsidizing the plowing up of cotton, corn, and other commodities. That is, subsidizing an economy of scarcity, for which there was no market. Now, all of Roosevelt's New Deal measures, the bulk of which, as I say, was designed to aid the capitalists to restore viability to the economic structure, resulted in a union revival in the period 1933-34, latter part of 1933, and especially in 1933, the big textile strikes took place. Most of them were smashed and were but a forerunner of the big strikes that took place in the following year. The real turn came in 1934, the real turn in the trade union development. And it came with the intervention of the radicals in Minneapolis, Toledo, and on the Pacific coast. In Minneapolis, we had the comrades are familiar with the development there, the Trotskyist comrades in Minneapolis, who led the organization of the Teamsters Union, resulted in the big strikes in May 1934, and in the organization of the Teamsters, which later expanded to the organization of the overload drivers in the Middle West. In 1934, you had the Toledo Autolite strike, in which the primary and decisive role was played by the American Workers' Party, the Musty Group. In Toledo through their unemployed organization. I think they called it the Unemployed Leagues, if I'm going to say. Howard, you remember? Unemployed Leagues, was it? The Unemployed Leagues, I think, is what they knew. Anyway, in Toledo, as was characteristic of all the strike struggles of that period, the moment the workers went on strike, the employers got an injunction. And they always found a court ready to hand down an injunction limiting the number of pickets, the kind of picketing, and sometimes ruling picketing illegal and outlawing it altogether. The Toledo Unemployed Leagues, under the leadership of the Mustyites, the AWP, threw the unemployed workers onto the picket line and said they were going to fill the prisons, fill the jails of Toledo, in violation of this injunction. This was a new note in the struggle for unionization in that period. And their intervention was so successful that the workers won the strike, and the company had to sign, recognizing the union, the United Automobile Workers. It wasn't the United Automobile Workers then, later became the United Automobile Workers as their collective bargaining agent. You have the Trotskyists in Minneapolis, the Mustyites, the American Workers' Party in Toledo, and on the West Coast you had the Communist Party and a whole conglomeration, the Wobblies and the Trotskyists and the Socialist Party, with independent radicals contributing their bit. The maritime unions were smashed by the government in 1921. In 1921, the government, which had set up its own hiring halls to hire seamen for the merchant marine during the period of the war, smashed the unions, and they existed as a mere shell on both the East and the West Coast until 1933-1934. The industrial workers of the world had their own maritime union, which they called the Marine Transport Workers. They had quite a few of the militants among the seamen, and the seamen were traditionally known for their militancy, organized in the MTW, but they had no contracts. In fact, the Wobblies didn't believe in contracts. They wouldn't sign contracts even if the boss offered them. In 1933-34, you had the Communist Party during its left period, which was initiated under the aegis of the Sixth World Congress, organizing seamen and the Marine Workers Industrial Union. They were organizing revolutionary industrial unions in all fields in competition with the American Federation of Labor. And they also had contracts with the seamen, with the ship owners. But they had a considerable number of seamen, militant, revolutionary workers, organized in the Marine Workers Industrial Union. Now, the strike broke out and was led by a company union, so-called Blue Book Union, which replaced the unions that the government had smashed in 1920-21. The ship owners had set up their own hiring hall and compelled everybody working on the front to carry a ship owner's hiring book. That is a think book. It was called the Blue Book Union, and they were the ones who led the strike and affiliated to the American Federation of Labor Longshoremen, AFL Longshoremen, then under the leadership of that ineffable character, Joe Ryan, J. Joe Ryan, if you remember, who was exposed by the McClellan Committee as a gangster, a racketeer, so forth and so on, had to resign from the union after they had elected, I think the year after they had elected him for life. He was elected president for life. What a mortification. A year later, he was out on his ass.
For life.
He recently died. God bless him. At any rate, it was the existence of these radicals of various hues on the West Coast that imparted to this struggle its militant character from the very beginning. Anti-government, anti-employer. And they fought against the police, the National Guard, the government representatives, the employers, and succeeded in compelling the ship owners to recognize the Longshore Union. And it was the first strike in which the workers won the six-hour day, which they subsequently surrendered under the leadership of Bridges in 1934. The seamen went back to work without a contract and without recognition. But so great was the militancy that no one dared sail aboard a ship who wasn't sent out of the Union Hall. They weren't recognized by the ship owners. They had no contract. They had no right to send anybody out of their own Union Hall. They had no right to have a Union Hall. But anybody who sailed aboard a ship that didn't carry a Union card found himself wet, dripping wet, and off of the ship. They were able to enforce, their control, and never did win the Union Hiring Hall until 1936 in the 99-day strike from October, November, December, and January, up to January 1937, when the seamen were recognized and the Union Hiring Hall of the seamen was recognized at that time. So the radicals played a very important role in these sort of harbingers of the tremendous wave of organization that swept the entire country under the aegis of the CIO. There was tremendous dissatisfaction in the AFL among a number of the leaders of the AFL, headed by John L. Lewis. Lewis, Dubinsky, Hillman, Howard of the Typographical Union, and a number of others, who realized that the organization of these workers in the mass production industries was impossible under the philosophy of the ruling bureaucrats in the AFL. Now, the AFL made certain concessions. They had to. They couldn't begin to organize these workers on the basis of parceling them out to the various craft unions who had been granted jurisdiction. The concession they made was to organize them in what they call federal unions, that is, unions affiliated directly to the AFL Council, and said that, well, we'll organize them under this form, organize them, all the workers in the plant, in the form of federal unions, and then later we'll carve them up among the international unions which comprise the AFL-CIO according to their jurisdictional claims. That is, they were sort of second-class citizens. They weren't granted the rights of an international union in the American Federation of Labor, but as a federal union which had very little right. Most of its officers were appointed by the AFL Council, and it was under this form that they attempted to meet the objections of the, that section of the AFL leaders who insisted upon organizing the mass production workers on the in the industrial form of organization. That didn't work. It was a tremendous amount of dissatisfaction. And these militants in these industries insisted upon having something to say about their rights. At any rate, it led to the split in the American Federation of Labor and the formation of the Congress of Industrial Organizations. First, in the form of the Committee of Industrial Organizations of 10 of the international unions of the AFL, and then later they split organizationally, established the Congress of Industrial Organizations. Now, in this whole period, prior to 1921, the American Federation of Labor discriminated outrageously against Negroes. Most of the unions had bans on Negro membership in the union. Even those that didn't, or very few Negroes were permitted to belong to any of the AFL craft unions. A result was, in a number of instances where, because of their justifiable outrage at being prevented from joining unions and becoming members of unions, Negroes were brought in as strike breakers by the industrialists who played upon the prejudice of the white workers, and many strikes were broken by Negro workers brought in by the industrialists. The CIO, in order to organize the workers in these mass production industries, especially in steel, in auto and rubber, had by this time found that a substantial section of the workers employed in these industries were Negroes. And they were compelled then to organize all of the workers employed without regard to race, color, creed, or previous condition of service, if they wanted to organize the workers in the plants. Because remember, although the workers were granted the right of joining unions and bargaining collectively, this right could only be established and was only established on the picket line. And characteristic of this whole period, from 1933-34 to 1939, with the outbreak of the war, practically all of the struggles, with few exceptions, were for one issue: union recognition. Many of the bitterest struggles fought at that period resulted only in the acquisition of this one concession, this one gain: union recognition. Recognition of the union as the collective bargaining agency of the workers in the particular plant. It was only after they had gained union recognition that the workers were able to go on from there and to begin to raise their wages, improve their working conditions, and lower their up. Also, there was another distinction between the movement under the control of the AFL from 21 to 35 to the rise of the CIO, and that was a difference of political philosophy. Under Gompers and then later under Green, the philosophy of the American Federation of Labor was summed up in the aphorism, you know, support your reward your friends and punish your enemies. That is, no politics in the union. The workers were kept atomized. The unions as such did not engage in political action, although that did not prevent the leaders of the unions from being very active, both in the Republican and Democratic Party. In fact, the pattern was that prominent international presidents appeared, especially during election campaigns, on both sides, on both the Republican side and the Democratic side. Daniel Tobin, for example, for a long time was a national committeeman of the Democratic Party. And in election campaigns, he was head up the labor section of the Democratic Party campaign. William Hutchinson, president of the Carpenters Union, was his counterpart on the Republican side. So in all election campaigns, Hutchinson would appear as the labor representative of the Republican Party in election campaigns, but no politics in the union. That is, the Carpenters Union as such could not endorse a candidate, or Tobin's Union, the Teamsters Union as such, could not endorse a candidate, nor could members of the unions actively engage in politics on either side of the two. Now, with the rise of the CIO, and with the attribution by the CIO leaders of the Roosevelt as the initiator of all good things for the labor movement, the policy was changed. That is, the CIO leaders proceeded to organize their section of the labor movement politically, not for independent action, but as an organized group for support of the Democratic Party and for the Roosevelt administration. They did it first in the form of John L. Lewis's Labor's Nonpartisan League. That is, they set out to organize the workers for political action, but as a supporting contingent for the Democratic Party. And even in cases like the state of New York, where there was a very powerful socialist sentiment among, especially among the immigrant workers in the needle trades unions, many of whom, most of whom had come over from Europe and who had been socialists in Europe before they came, and who felt that it was a betrayal and a violation of their class loyalty to walk into an election booth and vote for a Democrat or a Republican. They would no more do that than they would crash a picket line. That in order to overcome this resistance on the part of the more politically conscious immigrant workers in New York, they organized the American Labor Party. That is the origin of the American Labor Party in New York City. That is, Hillman, who was head of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers, he got together with some of his sharpshooters and decided that the only way they could get the workers in New York to support Roosevelt was to vote for Roosevelt on a Labor Party line. That is, the American Labor Party line. They could not get the workers to walk into a booth and vote for the Democrats, but they felt that they could, under the pretext that this constituted independent labor's political action, have them vote for Roosevelt on the American Labor Party line. And that's what happened. Beginning with that, you found the gradual erosion of the class consciousness that was characteristic of the large section of the working class movement in New York State, especially in New York City, which had consistently voted socialist for many, many years. We'll see how this fits in on this side tomorrow. Now, in 1937, despite all of the measures taken by Roosevelt and the New Dealers, there was a economic downturn within the cycle of the Depression. There was an upward swing in 1933, 1934, 1935, and 1936, and then a downturn in 1937, with still about 10 or 12 million unemployed. It indicated that the New Deal was incapable. That is, on the basis of the measures initiated by Roosevelt, there was no solution to the problem of economic crisis and unemployment under capitalism, and that's when the turn was made towards war in 1937 was when the steel workers, in trying to organize Little Steel in Chicago, Youngstown, and other places, were shot down in the Memorial Day Massacre. That's one of the used to be, one of the occasions on which the Steelworkers Union would have some memorial, a day recognizance of the struggle that took place then. Then in 1939, September, the war in Europe broke out with the signing of the Hitler-Stalin Pact and the beginning of the wartime boom in the American economy. That was production for war. And the 1941 Pearl Harbor and our entrance into the war as the United States entrance into the war against both Japan and Germany, against the so-called Axis. And a repetition from 1941 to 1945 of what we saw in the First World War, that is the whole proliferation of the agencies of class collaboration, the War Labor Board, the War Production Board, Office of Price Administration, so forth and so on, the no-strike pledge, surrender of the right to strike, maintenance of membership, and so forth and so on, in which the unions joined with the employers and the government to subordinate the struggle of the workers to the winning of the war. And we'll end there.
All these three were sparked by radical. That would mean that the great way culminated in the formation of the CIO was actually begun and given its initiative by small radical elements, people who carried it. Is that right?
Well, I will say this, that it was not only, it was not only the three, what I consider the three most significant struggles of that time, that gave an impulse to the organization of the industrial unions under the CIO, but it was also the participation of radicals in these AFL unions and in the formative periods of the CIO. Oh, yes. You mean than there are now? Well, if you counted the Communist Party, see, remember, I said we'll get into this discussion tomorrow. Remember, the Communist Party was in its third period then, its period of ultra-leftist adventurism, where they saw a revolution around every corner, and every strike was the beginning of a revolution, and therefore they could never end a strike, because you couldn't end a strike if it was the beginning of the revolution, except with the conquest of state power. But I mean, these were radicals. These were workers who genuinely felt that the revolution was on the agenda, and they went out in demonstration. I remember that period. And they had their heads cracked open time and time again by the cops. No, they didn't see behind the phoniness of the Stalinist line. But they were radicals. I would say they were radical. If anything, they were ultra radical. The Socialist Party at that time, even as small as it was, had a left wing in it. Then there were all kinds of independent radical groupings. I mentioned one, the American Workers' Party, Trotsky's, other radical groupings. They were all very active. The IWW, the Wobblies. It was a fairly large-sized movement at that, compared to what it is now. Now it's not even a ghost. But then they had their own organizations. As I say, they had the Marine Transport Workers, and in other fields, they also had organizations, much of which were on paper, but there were many militant strikes in textiles especially. And they had many, many thousands of workers who were Wobblies, who were militants, who were revolutionists. I should say the radicals played a very decisive role in the CIO.
How successful was the tactic of organizing young employees throughout the 30s? Is it generally a tactic that worked out?
Well, Remember, in the period of the 30s, the American Federation of Labor, they weren't interested in the unemployed itself. Not any more than they are today. The unemployed were nothing but a headache to them. In fact, in 1934, 35, during the period of the upsurge, Dan Tobin wrote an editorial in the International Teamsters magazine. The essence of the editorial is we got to keep the riffraff out of the Teamsters Union. What did he mean by the riffraff? He meant that those hundreds of thousands of workers who were unorganized, you see. Mm-hmm. The road drivers, the warehouse workers, and all of the workers that in and around the Teamsters Union. He considered the milk wagon drivers and the bread, you know, those people who were come around and were agents, you know, they'd work for themselves. They'd get a commission on how much milk they sold, how much bread they sold, coal dress, so forth. These were the people he considered fit for union organization. The rest he considered riffraff. This is characteristic of the AFL, the leadership of their Well, what do you think they thought about the unemployed? They didn't exist for them. So that when the Depression struck, let's say, the first reaction was one of shock. Well, then when workers finally, they exhausted whatever personal resources they had and what they could borrow from their friends and their families, they had nothing else, there began evictions. Well, then sort of spontaneously, the neighborhood, those who were unemployed also, would rally around whoever was the victim, and they would move their stuff back into the plant. They would fight the sheriff and the cops and everybody else. And so an unemployed movement arose almost spontaneously. Then the unemployed movements of the 30 were organized by the radicals. The CP had its own unemployed organization. The SP had its own unemployed organization. The American Workers' Party had its own unemployed organization. The CP organization, the unemployed councils, affiliated with the Workers' Alliance, which was led by the SP. So the unemployed were under the leadership of the radicals. So the radicals threw the unemployed workers into these struggles wherever they could. Later on, these unemployed workers who had gotten their experience in the unemployed organization became the militants of the 35s and 36s in the CIO. They became the organizers and the leaders of the militant struggle to establish the unions in the mass production industry. That's how it happened in the 30s. Oh, just a minute, oops. Any other further questions? Okay.